Really sweet time of worship, team. That's great. Yeah. Kim, good to have you back on the drums.
Yeah.
Jerry, glad you made it back from Texas, okay. Good to have you home. Hey, one thing that I wanted to mention today, can I borrow your bulletin, Steve, for a second? Regarding the chili cook-off and worship night coming up a week from Friday. We've got 5 entries so far for people who are going to put together magical recipes of chili. We need more. Did you put one in today, Tammy?
Yeah.
Right on. Okay, 6. There are there's several dozen cans of beans downstairs up for grabs. We had an overabundance of red beans and pinto beans and black-eyed peas. You can make awesome chili with black-eyed peas. Did you know that? Downstairs on the table, outside of Scribbles, you're welcome to help yourself to as many cans of beans as you want. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to be a good time. Thank you, Steve. Anybody ever hear the name Ernest Dichter? Is that a familiar name? Probably not. I'd never heard of it before this week. Ernest Dichter was a Jewish psychologist who was actually born in Vienna, and he's considered the father of modern consumer research. He kind of invented what we know of as the modern consumer focus group. Consumer focus group, when companies bring diverse group of individuals together to assess products and find out how to make them better, how best to please people with their products. Dichter kind of pioneered this sort of work. His first work in this field was in his home city of Vienna. He was hired by a milk company to do personal interviews of milk drinkers, to research the habits of milk drinkers, to help companies sell more milk, essentially. And he began to branch off into different products and different companies. When he came to the United States, when his family emigrated to New York in the 1930s, he sought work in this field, and his first job in market research was with Ivory Soap. And so he started employing his interview skills to Ivory Soap users, and what he found was that taking a bath with Ivory Soap, it was much more than just a hygiene thing for people. It kind of represented a psychological cleansing, to take a bath with Ivory Soap. And so he came up with the slogan and the campaign, "For a fresh start, take an ivory bath." And they sold a lot of soap, a lot more soap than they were selling before, because Dichter knew what he was doing. Today, companies spend millions, billions of dollars in market research, trying to find out how best to please their customers and sell more products. It's kind of ironic, however, that some of our most ubiquitous products are the result of companies who reject that conventional wisdom and just make a product that they believe in. The telephones that most of us are carrying in our pockets, prior to 2007, you remember what mobile phones and smartphones looked like then? Really tiny screens and a whole lot of buttons. Well, the guys at Apple Inc., they realized they didn't like their phones. And so they wanted to build a phone that they would like to use. And they don't like using focus groups. They just built a phone that they would want to use. And today, you know, 80% of the population carries phones in their pockets that have no buttons or very few buttons and just look like a baby television screen. So sometimes trying to get the public consensus is not the way to go. And I feel like this is a really good launching point for our scriptural discussion today, because our scriptural discussion today has to do with market research, in a sense, and not about selling products, but selling ourselves. It's very easy to kind of assume a market research approach to life, where I become the product, and I try to determine how best to please the people around me. You know, what's the most inviting, the most marketable version of myself that I can sell to people in terms of my appearance, my personality? How can I please people the most? That's how it comes really naturally for us to live. We want to please those around us. Every one of us likes to be affirmed and to feel like people approve of us. But living with that as a guiding principle, how best can I please people? It comes very naturally, but it's also not a good way to live. I'd say it's a very easy way to live, people-pleasing, but it's a disastrous recipe for living. Because when you live to please other people, it leads to very poor choices. And it does not result in the righteousness of God.
Right.
If I'm trying to live my life to please you, I can't live to please God. And we are in the midst right now of a scriptural passage. We're going to meet a couple of people-pleasers who make some very bad decisions, some very dark decisions because they want to please people. Now, these decisions are all part of the ultimate sovereign plan of God. God can take our bad choices and use them for his purposes, absolutely. But we're going to focus in on these people pleasers and maybe learn a little bit about how to avoid living that way, to not live according to market research and how best we can please other people, but how best we can please God. We're currently in the season that much of the Christian church regards or is known as Lent. Lent is the period of time of weeks prior to Easter when we put special focus on the events surrounding and following the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. We're taking our time through this part of Luke's gospel, Luke chapters 22, 23, and 24. Because there's so much nuance and so much detail in the account of the events surrounding Jesus' arrest and crucifixion. There's so much to glean out of these passages, and I just pray, I've been on my face all week, just praying that God would speak to us through His Word, through these verses that we're going to read. We're going to look at part of chapter 23 of Luke today. As we begin looking at Luke 23, where we're at in the story, we know that Jesus has been betrayed by a traitorous hypocrite. He was betrayed by Judas, one of his 12 followers, who had everybody fooled, who used his proximity to Jesus to make some coin for himself. He made an arrangement with the Jewish authorities who wanted Jesus out of the way. They wanted Jesus gone, silent. They wanted Jesus dead. So Judas made a deal with them to get Jesus in a place away from the crowds where he could be arrested and it wouldn't cause a riot. And he did so for 30 pieces of silver. So that's already gone down. Another thing that's happened is that Jesus was abandoned by those closest to him, by those who pledged their eternal loyalty to him. They'd stand by him, come what may. Well, at the first sign of danger, these guys gave in to their instincts and they fled. They ran off into the night. And so throughout that night, through the dark early morning hours, Jesus is guarded by the Roman soldiers while the Jewish authorities gather and wait for daybreak so they can interrogate and convict him. Now, for these Roman soldiers, guarding is synonymous with abusing. And all through the night, they thump on Jesus. They hit him. They punch him. They press a crown of thorns on his brow and mock him. That's what Jesus goes through all night. And then at daybreak, Jesus is taken before the former high priest of the Jews, Annas, and the current high priest, Caiaphas. These guys were related. They were in-laws. Jesus is first interrogated by them. And as he's interrogated by Annas and Caiaphas, both of whom hate Jesus, both of whom want Jesus gone, many different witnesses come forward and testify against Jesus, but they can't get their testimonies to agree. They're telling lies about Jesus. And it's a farce. It's a mockery of justice. It wasn't a trial. They're going through the motions so they can get him convicted and sentenced to death. The second phase of this early morning trial begins when the Jewish authorities have to take their prisoner to the next level of authority, the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was a man who had great authority in this part of the world, in Palestine, but he had a very significant character flaw. Pontius Pilate was a people pleaser. Through him and through others in this passage, may we learn a little bit about the foolishness of trying to live for the purpose of pleasing people. So I'm going to ask you to read along silently if you have your Bibles in Luke chapter 23 as I begin reading in verse 1. Luke 23:1 says this, "Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, 'We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. He claims to be Messiah, a king.' So Pilate asked Jesus, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' 'You have said so,' Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests in the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and he's come all the way here." Well, on hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sends him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he'd hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. And then Herod and the soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. But that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. Pilate called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was inciting the people to rebellion. I have examined him in your presence, and I have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." But the whole crowd shouted, "Away with this man! Release Barabbas to us!" Barabbas had been thrown into prison for an insurrection in the city and for murder. Wanting to release Jesus, Pilate appealed to them again, saying, but they kept shouting, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" For the third time, he spoke to them, "Why? What crime has the man committed? I found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I will have him punished and then release him." But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. One thing that's striking to me in this account is how little Jesus said compared to how much he could have said. Jesus was a master at silencing accusers, at silencing opposition with just a few words. I love people who have such a command of the language and of the issues that can do that. There are those in the conservative spotlight who I like to listen to because they have such a great command of the English language and they're able to answer those who argue and debate them with seeming fearlessness. They don't really seem to care what people think of them. Many people don't like her, but I like listening to Ann Coulter. I think of the occasion back in 2015 when she was on a show with Bill Maher and a panel of people who really didn't like her. And Maher asked her, this is 2015, long before the recent presidential election. They said, "So who do you think is going to be the Republican candidate for president?" And Ann Coulter said, "Well, among the declared candidates right now, Donald Trump." And the whole crowd just erupted in hilarious laughter and just mocking her. "Donald Trump, you don't know what you're talking about, lady." And she just sat there. She didn't really care, you know, but she was right. I like listening to Ben Shapiro, editor of the Daily Wire. This guy is so knowledgeable about conservative issues, great with the English language. He spends a lot of time on college campuses talking to large gathered groups of students, and some students will just throw their arguments at him thinking they've got him stumped, and he just shuts them down with a few words. He was at a campus recently, and a gal was questioning him and challenging him on the whole issue of gender identity. And her insistence was that biological females should be allowed into the Boy Scouts if they identify as males. And she said, you're degrading their humanity by saying they shouldn't be allowed into the Boy Scouts. And Shapiro says, "No, I'm not degrading their humanity. I'm just saying the Boy Scouts have a standard. You have to be a biological boy to be a Boy Scout." And she says, "Well, where is that written?" And Shapiro says, "In the title, Boy Scouts." Just shut the argument down. Now, as much as I like listening to folks like that, I like listening to Jesus exponentially more. Because Jesus' mic drop moments are just so powerful. When Jesus was challenged, when the authorities came to him asking him about taxes, they wanted to trap him. So we're going to ask him if it's okay to pay taxes to Rome, because if he says yes, then the people will hate him. If he says no, the Romans will arrest him. So they asked Jesus in public, where everyone is hearing, is it okay to pay taxes to Caesar? You remember what Jesus did? Took a coin, had Caesar's pictures on it, and he says, okay, give to Caesar what belongs to him, but make sure you give to God what belongs to God. Boom. Argument over. Debate won. The time also when probably some of the same religious authorities, they confronted Jesus in public and they had found a woman who was caught in the act of adultery, sexual immorality. They threw her in front of Jesus and they said, okay, our law says she should be executed. What do you say? Another time they thought they had him trapped. It's like, okay, if he says yes, she should be stoned, people are going to hate him. And if he says no, we can arrest him as a lawbreaker. Remember Jesus' reply? Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Whoosh, complete silence. Nobody had an answer for that. Everybody just walked away. It's like, we're done. We're beat. Jesus can shut down debaters and arguments so easily. My point is, he didn't do that in this case. When he's standing before Pilate, he could have, they were accusing him of saying it was wrong to pay taxes. He could have produced witnesses and said, no, people heard me say it's okay to pay taxes as long as you obey what God says, you know. He could have shut Pilate down. He could have performed miracles for Herod, but he didn't. He just answered. He just spoke very simple, clear, to the point truth about himself. He is the Son of God. And I reflected on that and I thought, man, if I were in a similar situation, I was being falsely accused. I mean, it is hard to be silent when you're being attacked, isn't it? Especially if you're being falsely attacked, if someone is saying lies about you, everything in human nature wants to answer that, wants to debate, wants to argue. And I maintain that Jesus was tempted to do just that. That Jesus in his mind and heart, because he was tempted in every way that we are, I think Jesus was thinking, man, I could shut these guys down. He could have said things and did things that got him a favorable response, but he didn't, because that wouldn't have accomplished the righteousness of his Father. I think it's fair to wonder, why did Pontius Pilate have to get involved at all? Why couldn't they have just convicted and sentenced him? And in fact, Pilate himself in the Gospel of John said, why don't you guys take him and judge him according to your own? Do it yourself. He was kind of put out to have to deal with their issues at this point. But they gave him, in their answer, they revealed their motives. When he said, why don't you judge him yourselves? They said, we don't have the right to execute anyone. Their motives are revealed. They didn't have the right to execute anyone. You see, they didn't want to jail Jesus. They didn't want to slap him with a big fine. They wanted to kill him. They wanted to execute him. And under Roman law, the Jewish government didn't have the authority to administer capital punishment. This is really, really significant, prophetically. Probably more significant than we realize. The fact that the Jews could not execute, they couldn't administer capital punishment. They couldn't judge capital cases. Okay, prophecy students, listen up, because this is really, really cool. All right? I'm going to compare Scripture with Scripture, because that's the best way to understand the Bible. Way back in Genesis chapter 49, you remember Jacob, the patriarch, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel? Way back when Jacob is on his deathbed, he brought each of his 12 sons before him and he blessed them, gave them a specific, unique blessing. And when his son Judah came before him, Judah, from whom the tribe of Judah would come, the kingly tribe, the tribe that King David came from, the tribe that Jesus himself belonged to. Here's what Jacob said to Judah, Genesis 49. He said, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes to whom it belongs. Okay, that's a way of saying the scepter won't depart from Judah. That's a way of saying Judah is going to be the kingly tribe and who's going to rule Israel, and they're going to be a sovereign nation until something happens, until the one comes to whom that scepter really belongs. Now, most Orthodox Jews universally believe this is referring to Messiah, that the scepter is going to remain with Judah until the Messiah comes. Now, in the minds of Orthodox Jews, their right to govern themselves, their right to be a sovereign nation, was linked inextricably to their ability to enforce capital punishment. And during their many years of turbulent Old Testament history, they were able to administer capital punishment. They were able to put criminals to death if they chose to. Even during the Babylonian captivity, the 70 years when they were out of the land, when they were in Babylon and then Persia, they were still able to administer capital punishment to those in their midst who they deemed guilty. But something happened in the year 6 CE. A Roman procurator named Coponius, he revoked the authority of the Jewish leadership to administer capital punishment. 6 CE, the year 6. No more could Jews pronounce death and administer capital punishment. All capital cases from that point on had to be brought before the Roman authorities. So now the power of life and death for the Jews was in the hands of the Roman government. And in the Jews' minds, that meant the scepter had departed from them. And many Jews at this time, they were heartbroken. They were in despair because they understood Jacob's prophecy, the scepter will not depart until the Messiah comes. That's what they expected. And here, the right to administer capital punishment was taken from them. The scepter had departed. And in their minds, Messiah had not yet come. And yet, and in fact, a rabbi, a historian, wrote of that time. He said, when the members of the Sanhedrin found themselves deprived of their right to life and death, they exclaimed, woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah, and the Messiah has not yet come. Now, the fascinating part, the year 6 CE, what they didn't know was that just some 70-some miles to the north, in the town of Nazareth, there was a small boy growing up, son of a carpenter named Jesus. See, the scepter departed because the true king had arrived. He'd come. They just didn't know it yet. So the Jews, they want to execute Jesus. They have to take him to a higher court, presided by the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. It's Pilate, not Pilates. Pilate. As I said, Pilate was a man with great political power, but he had a glaring personal weakness. He was a people pleaser, and he had to be a people pleaser. He had to be, because it was a matter of political survival for him. He was an imperial power ruler in an occupied land. And he had a hard job, admittedly. He had to execute the commands from the empire, from the emperor, from Rome. But he had to live amongst the Jews who hated him. And so if he was too lenient on the Jews, he'd hear it from his superiors. But if he was too hard on the Jews, then there would be uprising and trouble and conflict right where he lived. So he had a hard job, because he was always displeasing someone. You know, there's a dynamic there that I think we have to recognize too, that if you're going to lead people, if you're going to lead any people, you're going to displease people sometimes. What's the old saying? You can please some, I don't want to George W. Bush this one. You can please some of the people all of the time. You can please all of the people some of the time, but you can't please all the people all the time. That's especially true if you've got to lead somebody or lead a group of somebodies. If you're a parent, you know this, that if you're gonna parent successfully, you're not going to please your kids all the time. If you're a manager and leading a team at work, or if you have employees under you, you're going to have to make decisions that aren't universally popular. If you're involved in church leadership, you're oftentimes going to displease some people in the decisions you have to make. Once my wife and I were talking and praying about how the Lord would deal with the fact that someone was really, really displeased with me with a decision that I made. And my wife made this statement, and I'm going to hang on to it. She said, a leader that makes everyone happy isn't a leader. It's okay if I quoted you, right? But it's true. I mean, if you've got to lead, you can't please everybody. And if you make everybody happy, you're not a leader. And a man in Pilate's position couldn't please everyone. Now, Pilate was a people pleaser, but again, he wasn't a people pleaser because out of emotional need. It was out of political survival. And in making his political and his policy, his judicial decisions, he was motivated. He had good reason to try and make decisions that would make the fewest waves, that would upset the fewest people, because if he upset the Jews too much, they would revolt, and then he could lose his job. He could hear about it from the emperor. And if he couldn't keep the Jews under control, he wouldn't be the governor for very long. So when they first come to Pilate, throwing their accusations at Jesus out, he's inconvenienced, he's annoyed, and he tries to pass the buck. He learns that Jesus was from the north, from the area of Galilee, and just so happens that Herod Antipas specifically, who presided over the area of Galilee, was in Jerusalem at that time. So he sent Jesus to Herod. Now this is not the Herod of the nativity story. This is the son of that Herod. That was Herod the Great. Herod the Great in the Christmas story, who killed all the babies in and around Bethlehem. Herod Antipas was his son. And Herod Antipas had jurisdiction over roughly 25% of his father's territory, including Galilee. This is the Herod that we read about in the Gospels, who married his brother's wife. Remember that Herod? The one who beheaded John the Baptist. This is Herod Antipas. And so they bring Jesus before Herod Antipas, and you get the sense that Herod is not really all that concerned about Jesus' claims of being Messiah. He just kind of wants Jesus put on a show for him. Wants Jesus to do some kind of miracle. And when Jesus refused to even answer Herod, well, they put on this elegant robe and they begin to mock him and treat Jesus like an idiot. And Herod can't do anything with him, so he sends Jesus back to Pilate. Now, Luke points out something curious happened. He says that before that time, Herod and Pilate had been enemies. This little interaction between them, suddenly they forged a friendship. Curious. And I don't know what the significance of that is. One commentator suggested that's simply because Jesus is the great uniter. That their interaction with Jesus brought peace between these two men who formerly hated each other. For some reason, their hostilities with each other melted after both of them had spent time in the presence of Jesus. I think Herod and Pilate find out that they weren't so different after all. You know, Herod, he was a Jew. He hated Romans. Pilate hated the area of Galilee because there was a lot of revolt, a lot of uprisings there. But somehow they realized, hey, we're not so different after all. Both Herod and Pilate were people pleasers. Herod was a different kind of people pleaser, though. Herod wasn't as motivated to please his constituency as Pilate was. Herod was really the worst kind of people pleaser. Herod only wanted to please himself. That's the worst kind of people pleaser. Herod just wanted Jesus to entertain him. Oh, Jesus, I've been wanting to see you. Amuse me. Do something amazing. Jesus wouldn't comply. And so Pilate just proceeds to lead his whole court in mocking Jesus. Herod was a self-pleaser. He was one who was committed to his own gratification, his own whims. And that also comes very easily to human nature, doesn't it? To live for our own benefit, to look out for number one. And one thing you realize very quick if you're trying at all to live biblically is you can't live as a self-pleaser and a God-pleaser at the same time. You got to pick one or the other, because you can't live to please yourself ultimately and also please God at the same time. You know, the Apostle Paul warns us of that contradiction and that deception. He tells us that that's going to be one of the reasons that the self-pleaser is going to be one of the things that make the end times so terrible. He says there will be terrible times in the last days because people will be lovers of themselves rather than lovers of God. I mean, this characterizes 21st century culture. I think being a self-pleaser, being lovers of self, is the reason behind so much narcissism, so much crime, so much addiction, so much compulsions. When I'm living according to my own drives, my own compulsions and cravings, when that takes precedence over everything else, it's destructive to my own life, and it's decay to society, and it's slavery, really. It is slavery living to please yourself, because those who live to please themselves are never pleased. Those who prioritize their own satisfaction above everything else, they're never satisfied. And that's what's so liberating about the Christian faith, is to realize that I wasn't wired to live for myself. I was wired and created to live for somebody much greater than me. And how that was very, it was an epiphany for me when I was a brand new Christian to realize I had been living for myself all these years, and it had created so much frustration, so many destroyed relationships, and to realize I wasn't made to live for myself. I was made to live for Him. I can live for something greater than myself. Well, Herod, he's a self-pleaser. So he sends Jesus back to Pilate. Pilate, the people-pleaser. And Pilate tries to do the right thing. He wants to give a judgment according to his conscience, but the people's disapproval drowns out his conscience. He tries to compromise with them. He offers to have Jesus punished, which the other gospel writers tell us he carried out. He had Jesus beaten with the lash, had Jesus torn to shreds. And he presented Jesus before the crowds. I think Pilate was certain that once they saw Jesus just in that horrible, mutilated state, that their anger would be appeased. But he kind of underestimated their anger and wickedness. He underestimated their hatred of Jesus. He offers to follow through with a long-recognized tradition that during Passover, which they were in the midst of, that it was a tradition that Rome could set free a prisoner that was guilty. And so he gives him a choice. He gives a choice between Jesus and a guy named Barabbas, a known murderer. And he thought, oh, surely the Jews' hatred of Jesus wouldn't drive them to allow for the release of a murderer. But again, he underestimated their hatred of Jesus. And they insist, they shout down Pilate's appeals for reason. He's done nothing. Crucify him. And Pilate just wanted to create the fewest waves possible. He wanted to get by with the least amount of hassle. And pleasing the people seemed to be what was in his best interest. He overruled his own conscience in order to please people. Do you ever find yourself in a similar dilemma where your conscience says one thing, but the voices around you seem to be saying something opposite? And doing the right thing, listening to your conscience, listening to the voice of the Spirit of God, is going to be really inconvenient or really expensive or really, really costly to you or uncomfortable. As I said earlier, I firmly believe that Jesus was tempted to say or do whatever he could to allow that cup to pass from him. Because he had a human nature, and somewhere in that human nature, I think he was tempted to vindicate himself, but he didn't. He set for us an example. I mean, we're never going to face a challenge of that magnitude. But we do face challenges regularly where we have to listen to the voice of the Spirit and ignore the voice of the world. Again, the writers of the New Testament told us we're going to have this conflict. Paul said, am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God, or am I trying to please men? If I were trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ. I can live for pleasing people like Pilate. I can live for pleasing myself like Herod. But my role model is Jesus. And Jesus sought to please the Father. We can't follow two role models. We can't follow the world and Christ. It's two different directions. And in all honesty, I see a lot more of myself in Pilate and Herod than I like to admit. But the more we look at Jesus, the more we want to be like Him.
That's right.
I look at Jesus, and even in the midst of His greatest hour of suffering, the darkest hour of His life, Jesus was still confident. He was confident and stood His ground. I want to be like that. Pilate was wishy-washy. Pilate was like Charlie Brown. It's like, but, He didn't do anything. Crucify Him. He was not confident in His own judgment. So He allowed Himself to be manipulated. And Jesus had full confidence in His position. Even though Jesus' position in judgment on Himself and judgment on what to do would bring Him unimaginable suffering, He was confident. And you know, that's an incentive for us. Because a God-pleaser is confident in judgment. I want to be the kind of man who knows what he knows, who makes correct judgments and stands by what he believes, even if it goes against the crowd. You know, there's a series of experiments done in the 50s by a guy named Solomon Ash. Maybe you've heard about this. He conducted a series of experiments that dealt with social pressure and conformity. And one of his most famous experiments, what he would do is he would take a group of 8, usually college-age men, and he would show them 2 cards. One, the first card had a single line on it. That was the reference line. And then they had to pick on the second card which line matched the length of the first card. See, but the way he set up the experiment is that 7 of the 8 guys in the room had special instructions. They were instructed to give the correct answer a couple of times. But then, like 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th time they were showed cards, start giving the wrong answer. Start saying that line B is the same length as the reference line. So only one guy in the group would be giving an honest answer. And furthermore, the experiment was told to ask that 8th guy last. So when the guys who were in on the ruse were asked, okay, which line matches the reference line? Oh, B, 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 right down the line, B, B, B. When they get to that last guy who was thinking he was nuts, hey, it's got to be C. 75% of the time, that last guy would agree with the crowd. He'd say, yeah, B, B. Which tells us most people would rather sit there and say that a long line is short rather than go against the consensus of the crowd. But Jesus gives us a different role model. Jesus gives us a different template. That you can be one who trusts your judgment. You can be that 8th person who says, no, C is the same length. You guys are blind. But it's so hard when the crowd is going one way and you got to go a different way. You guys remember the song we used to sing at home? Do not follow the crowd when they do what is wrong. You'll be sorry if you choose to go along. So true. And that's a truth we gotta ingrain in our hearts all the time. Being a God pleaser means I can be confident. There are times when we have to courageously stand against the crowd. Again, in parenting, sometimes you got to stand against the consensus of your children or grandchildren. Well, gee, Dad, Larry Mondello's mom lets him eat candy for breakfast. It's not going to happen with you. In the workplace, a lot of times you got to stand against the crowd. When your coworkers are trash-talking the boss or maybe trash-talking their spouses, you guys ever experienced that at work? And you got to walk away because that's not honoring to Christ. That's not honoring to your spouse. Social situations, when everyone at work, oh, we're going to meet at the bar after work for a few drinks. No thanks. I'll head home. Or when everyone's going to watch that movie that glorifies sin and wickedness, and you got to say, I'll take a pass. Do not follow the crowd when they do what is wrong. Easier said than done, isn't it? But being a God pleaser means we can be confident in our judgment.
Right.
Another thing about God pleasers are not afraid to take responsibility. Neither Pilate nor Herod wanted to take responsibility for making a decision about Jesus. You make the call. No, you make the call. They kept passing him back and forth. But a God pleaser, I'm not afraid to take response. I'm not afraid to make decisions because I'm going to be prayerful about my decision. I'm going to seek the Lord, and to the best of my understanding of God's will, I'm going to make my decisions in accordance to what I believe God's will to be. And if I'm wrong, I'll be teachable. If I'm wrong, I'll be quick to correct my course. But I'm going to take responsibility and make decisions. You know, one frustration Debbie and I had in her recent injury is that the many medical professionals that we had to consult, none of them seemed to want to make a decision about how to treat her injury. They just kept wanting to prescribe more pills and have her take more expensive tests. But no one wanted to say, no, here's what you need to do. Here's the exercises you need to do to get better. Here's how long you need to take. Nobody wanted to make a decision because that would make them liable. You know, we live in a culture that is afraid to take responsibility. We live in a culture where fathers are afraid to take responsibility for their families, where politicians are afraid to take responsibility. They want their poll numbers to go up, but they don't want to take the responsibility of making the hard decisions. We live in a culture of ministry leaders who only want to please the congregation and not have to make the hard decisions of shepherding. Who are we trying to please? Are we trying to please others? Are we living to please ourselves? Again, I refer to the words of Paul. If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ. Who do we want to serve? Who do we want to trust? You see, because those who you serve, those are the ones you trust. Do I trust the whims of people enough to try and live my life pleasing them? No, I don't. I do not. I trust my Lord. He's the one that's shown me unfailing love. He's the one that's shown me unshakable faithfulness. And so, by His grace, we will live to please Him. We will live to serve Him. You know, as we mourn the passing of Billy Graham, of a godly man, you know, I've been thinking about the occasion when I went to a Billy Graham crusade before I was saved. And I thought I was going to be bored out of my gourd, but I was very compelled by what I heard. You know, it was several years before I received Christ. But I saw something real in Brother Graham and in those who worked with him and those who brought me. I saw something real that several years down the line made me ready to accept the invitation and to follow the path of the song that I remember them singing at that crusade. When it says, I've decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. Though none go with me, still I will follow. Why don't we close here with a few quiet moments? Give each of us a few moments to reflect on the God that we follow. And reaffirm that willingness that when the crowd goes one way away from my Lord, I'm not going to follow them. I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm not going to allow compromise to be a part of my character. I'm not going to allow my integrity to be divided because of the pressure to conform. Because it's going to get harder, folks, each year that passes, it's going to get harder and harder to follow Christ in this world, in this country, in this culture. We've got to expect it to get harder, not easier. But we have the Spirit of God in us, and greater is He that is in us than he that is in the world. Let's reflect for a few moments, shall we? Join me, Z.